I swear we're generally better than this, David.
No, we're not. We're terrible.
All podcasts are just like this.
All right, here we go again.
Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast designed to cover the legal information profession with a slant toward technology and management. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So Marlene, this week we talk about legal publishers and sole providers with David Whelan of the Great Library of the Law Society of Ontario, as well as our monthly update with Emily Feltrin of the American Association of Law Libraries about recent events in Washington regarding government action on the legal information industry. So this one's going to be a great one.
We dig in quite a bit with David about his article, The No Legal Research Provider Landscape, which he posted on his blog. So we talk about information licensing restrictions and preferences and maybe even a bit of habit and their impact on the choice of providers, as well as how there may be more creative and useful options out there. And another big issue, how we are operating a bit blindly because we really don't have quality or maybe any data in terms of what firms and courts and in-house counsel and single practitioners and everybody are using and how. Mm-hmm. Our recent AALL State of the Profession survey tackles this somewhat, but this is a deep dive niche that is just begging to be filled.
Yeah.
Having that sort of data would be gold in terms of understanding various licensing choices.
During the interview, I kind of call out one vendor who does a survey for law libraries, and I won't give you their initials.
Don't say, because then everybody has to listen.
All
it's
right.
Teaser.
I'll hold off on that. There's a little teaser there. So, Marlene, we had a little fun last week about how we're doing the podcast wrong.
Yes, we did. We did.
And in fact, on Twitter, I got my first kind of weird flex, but okay, from Jared Correa of the Legal Toolkit podcast. And Jared, I love your podcast.
All right. So Jared, I just want to say when I talked to my teenage son about this, and he's just like, nobody says that anymore.
Oh, man.
But we do love your podcast.
Just when I thought I was cool. I thought
it was great too. And I was like, oh.
So I thought we'd have a little fun again this week and shake things up a bit and maybe improve the podcast. So Marlene, do you remember what it was like to take finals in law school?
You know, Greg, I really try to forget as much as possible about the law school experience. It's like not what I learned, just the experience.
Oh man, it's a stressful time. So
it is.
So for those of you who are listening that may not have gone to law school, there is only one grade for most of the classes, and that's the final. So you can go through the entire semester, do all the reading, brief all the cases, be prepared every day for class, go through that stress of wondering if today's the day that the professor is going to randomly call on you to stand up in front of everyone and explain the issues, the rules of law, the actions taken by the court.
Yeah, no stress there at all.
Not a bit. And even if you max that out, it doesn't matter unless you nail the final. And Marlene, I nailed a lot of finals.
Mm-hmm.
C plus. So it's a high pressure environment and it is not a fun time leading up to finals.
You know, we joke about it a little bit, but there's truly a lot of stress there because there's really, you know, an impact. It really determines the job options you have getting out of school. So students are investing heavily, and I mean heavily, in their future when they pay the bill for law school. It is very important to those taking these tests that they do well and have as many options as possible.
Yeah, I actually did. I taught adjunct one semester where I taught a property class at Oklahoma City University. And I gave one of the students a B+ on the final. And I thought he was going to kill me because he didn't get an A. So very stressful. So dealing with that stress, a lot of law schools now are trying to find ways in relieving the stress. And so we reached out to a few of our colleagues at law schools around the country to let us know what they are doing to help students not come unglued during the final season. Yeah, and we got some good answers. So finally, Marlene, that helpline is coming into use.
See, I knew the helpline was going to happen someday.
So this week, we're going to skip our information inspiration segment, and we're going to go in and play some of the voice memos from the different law schools about what they do to create a less stressful environment for their law students. So here's a few examples of reducing law student stress.
This is Rachel Evans, Metadata Services Librarian at UGA Law Library. This spring's round of exams, we have placed miniature plastic animal figurines throughout the library for students to pick up a free study buddy. We're also offering an event for virtual reality escape so that students can come and spend an afternoon playing games that include an underwater experience, fighting zombies, and even interactive Tetris.
Hey, this is Daniel Bell with the University of Tulsa. In the library, we have free snacks, granola and trail mix bars, and K-cups available at the CERC desk. That's been really popular. And we have an assortment of newer board games with an emphasis on cooperative instead of competitive games. Forbidden Island, Forbidden Desert, and easy-to-learn fast games like Taco Cat Goat Cheese. The games haven't been that popular a checkout item. I think they're too wrapped up in finals right now. But we're working on putting together a hosted game night sometime in the next week or so when there aren't a ton of finals the next day. We'll see how it goes, and we're looking for more ideas. Thanks.
Hi, this is Dan from the University of San Diego. During finals, we fire up our popcorn machine, which has proven to be a big hit with the students. We also put out some puzzles, Play-Doh, and coloring books as options for relaxation.
Hi, this is Heather Simmons from the University of Illinois College of Law Library in Champaign-Urbana. Professor Suja Thomas and I offer mindfulness training as part of first-year orientation. To have students experience the benefits of mindfulness firsthand, we hand out Dove chocolates for a guided 9-minute mindful eating practice. We then hold mindfulness sessions once a week throughout the semester. Our hope is that if students have established a consistent mindfulness practice during the year, then when exam time comes around, they will experience less stress.
So we skipped our interview last month with Emily Feltrin from AALL, but that doesn't mean that the government shut down, because that was back.
That was back in January.
So let's catch up on what the government is doing in regards to legal information. Joining us, as she does each month from Washington, D.C., is Emily Feltrin. Emily is the Director of Government Relations at the American Association of Law Libraries, and she's here to give us an update on important news regarding the government's impact on legal information. Hey, thanks for joining us, Emily.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me again.
So I know it's springtime in Washington, and I'm sure there's a lot more going on than the cherry tree blossoms. So what does spring bring for us this year?
So yeah, in addition to the beautiful blooms around town, it is budget and appropriation season on Capitol Hill.
Woo-hoo.
With heads of federal agencies making their annual treks to Capitol Hill to testify before the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. And it's also the time when organizations like AALL testify before the Appropriations Committees in support of their legislative priorities that require government spending. So this year, AALL has been busy speaking out in support of the budget requests of the Government Publishing Office and the Library of Congress. And while the appropriations process might sound dull, it's actually where some fascinating sausage making takes place and where real policy change can happen. For example, in FY fiscal year 2018, the appropriations committees included language in the omnibus spending bill directing the Library of Congress to provide online public access to Congressional Research Service reports. And now crsreports.congress.gov is up and running.
That's a big win for us.
It was decades in the making, literally. AALL President Femi Cadmus had the opportunity to testify on April 2nd before the U.S. House of Representatives Appropriations Subcommittee on the Legislative Branch during that subcommittee's public witness hearing, just like you did last year, Greg.
Yeah, that was definitely a highlight of my term.
It is a great opportunity to speak with Congress about our priorities and to have face-to-face time with members of Congress who have the unenviable job of figuring out how to allocate scarce resources.
Yes, yes.
President Cadmus's testimony called for full funding of the requested $31 million for the Government Publishing Office's Public Information Programs account, which supports the Federal Depository Library Program, or FDLP. And approximately 200 law libraries participate in that program, the FDLP, providing geographically distributed access to government information, both online and in print. AAL also urged support for the Law Library of Congress's $18 million request so that it may, among other important initiatives, complete its project to archive its global legal research reports and continue its digitization effort.
Okay.
AAL is strongly supportive of the Law Library's digitization strategy, and I'm pretty excited about it, actually. The Law Library is working to provide access to public domain U.S. legal and legislative materials and unique foreign law materials not subject to copyright restrictions and not otherwise available free of charge. Currently, the Law Library is working on digitizing the U.S. serial set, and it will then move to digitizing the Supreme Court records and briefs.
More information is always better.
Yeah, it's a really great project, and we're excited to see the results. AAL is grateful to the House Appropriations Subcommittee, particularly the chair, Tim Ryan, and ranking member Jamie Herrera Butler, for holding a public witness hearing, which allowed AAL's president to have the opportunity to testify about these important legislative branch agency priorities.
A little side note on both of them. Tim has apparently thrown his hat in for running for the presidency, and I think Jamie Herrera Butler was about, what, 8.5 months pregnant when she was doing this?
I don't know the due date, but she is definitely pregnant, and yeah, Tim Ryan announced 2 days after the hearing that he would be running for president.
Well, good luck to them both. So with Washington being so divided this session, what's the chances of these things going through for the budget?
So far, it's not clear what the final levels of spending will allow, with House Democrats having declined to take up a formal budget resolution for fiscal 2020 because of divisions within the caucus. Congress is in the middle of a 2-week recess, so we're in wait-and-see mode about the final level of spending appropriators will be working with to write their final fiscal 2020 bills. But one thing is for certain, AAL will continue to advocate in support of the appropriations requests of the Library of Congress and Law Library and the Government Publishing Office because of the critical role these legislative branch agencies play in providing access to government information and supporting the life cycle of information.
All right. Hey, thanks again, Emily, for joining us and giving us an update on what's happening in Washington in regards to the government's action on legal information. So I will talk to you next month.
Thanks, Greg.
All right. Bye-bye. Hey, before we get into David Whelan's interview, let's hear a few more examples of reducing law student stress.
Hi, Greg. This is Jesse Birchville from the UA Little Rock Bowen School of Law. Our law library hosted a Make Your Own Trail Mix table this year during what we call Stress Less Fest, which is a law school-wide activity. We also did a display of study aids, and our motto was Fuel Your Brain in the Library. Thanks. Bye.
Hi there. My name is Roger Skalbeck. I'm the Associate Dean for Library and Information Services at Richmond School of Law. I'm sharing a few examples of the ways we're helping reduce stress for students at our law school. This year we're providing a broad mix of things from puppies to puzzles, bookmarks to basketball. Since 2011, at least, we've been bringing therapy dogs to the law school for students to hang out with animals in our atrium. We also have a rotation of puzzles for students to complete as classes end and finals begin. It's a popular way to both pass the time and procrastinate. Our Harry L. Carrico Center for Pro Bono and Public Services offers a range of activities to support students while also supporting our community. Over coffees and pastries, students could color bookmarks for students in Richmond Public Schools and decorate tissue packets for area cancer patients. Led by the fabulous Tara Casey, the center also provides space during exams to study off-campus. The first 5 students to sign up also get a free lunch. Finally, each year we have a faculty versus students basketball game where our record is kind of like the Washington Generals. They seem to always lose to the Globetrotters. This year we expanded it to have a kickball game. Staff from across the school, including our dean, went head-to-head with about 24 students. We lost, but we hope to even out our record next year. Thanks for this chance to share a few ideas. At Richmond Law Library, we know exams can be stressful, but we hope these efforts help show support and reduce anxiety.
Hi, this is Philippa Marullo-Anzalone from Boston College Law School, and here for exams to help students, we have some extra meditation sessions, we have therapy dogs for 2 days, we offer candy and snacks at exam time, and we're also this year having 2 catered breakfasts on the 2 reading period days for students. So, thanks for asking. Bye-bye.
Hi, Greg. This is Teresa Miguel Stearns, Director of the Law Library at Yale Law School. We do quite a few things. I think one of the more well-known activities is our library mascot, Josie, comes in a few times over the course of the next few weeks during reading week and examinations. We also leave puzzles out around the library where students can take a break from the rigors of studying and be creative. And finally, we select a morning when there are a lot of exams scheduled in the building, and that morning we prepare home-baked goods and bring them into the student lounge and provide the students with some yummy snacks and treat the morning of their exams. Just about everybody in the library bakes or brings some goodies in for our students. So I hope this is helpful. Thanks, Greg. Love your podcast. Bye-bye.
And Marlene, Teresa didn't stop there. I stopped the recording, but I want you to listen to this next part because you remember a few episodes ago where you talked about pizza?
Of course. How could I forget about pizza?
You can never forget about pizza. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things we mentioned was that New Haven, Connecticut was listed as one of the great pizza places.
Yes, I do remember that.
Teresa backs that up. So let's
listen. What? All right, I got to hear this.
Oh, by the way, a few months ago during Pizza Week, the topic of the best pizza in the country came up. You and your co-host were both questioning New Haven as the source of the best pizza in the world. Well, I didn't believe it either until I moved here, and it is absolutely. Sally's, Pepe's, and Modern are the three best pizzerias on the planet. And even New Yorkers concede that New Haven pizza beats New York pizza. I'll be happy to expand upon this anytime. Thanks, Greg. Bye-bye.
It's like, wow. Okay. So if the New Yorkers are saying this, I want to know which New Yorkers they are, and I want to find them, and I want to ask them myself, because I've never heard of that before. I have never heard of New Yorkers conceding that someone else has better pizza than they do. But,
I'm pretty sure even if the New Yorkers did, the people from New Jersey are still not conceding anything.
You know, we have this reputation for being so difficult. I don't understand it.
I know one thing is that my family refuses to take you to any pizza places anymore. It's like, oh, this sauce is not fresh. Oh, this cheese.
Oh. You know, to be fair, it's like, you know, I would say that you know, Houston and Texas in general have a lot to learn about pizza. But saying that, I mean, I do like Luigi's and I do like Frank's.
Well, I like Luigi's because it's right next door to Axelrad's, which is this great bar.
That is an added benefit. So that was a lot of fun listening to what the different law schools are doing to reduce law student stress during finals. If your school has a program where you're trying to reduce law student stress during finals, give us a call on the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270 and leave us a short voicemail.
So we're hoping that we'll have a few more for next week, and then we'll get back into our regular scheduled programs of information inspirations. So Marlene, let's jump into our interview with David Whelan of the Great Library of the Law Society of Ontario. Joining us today is David Whelan. David is the Director of Legal Information and the Great Library at Law Society of Ontario in Toronto, Canada. I love the Great Library part. So David, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Greg. Thanks, Marlene.
You recently penned an article on your blog entitled The No Legal Research Provider Landscape. In that article, you talk about the different options that those of us in the legal industry have when it comes to selecting which resources that work best for the individual lawyers, law firms, the corporations, the courts, the schools, et cetera, et cetera. The options seem to be limitless, but of course the budgets aren't. So let's start with what you call the sole provider selection. So I think the three of us understand what it means to have a sole provider when it comes to law firms' legal research tools. But would you mind clarifying for everyone what it means as we talk about sole providers and how that's applied to institutions outside of law firms?
For sure. The sole provider concept is a longstanding one. And it really, I think, comes from the time when we had two primary choices in the commercial market, either the Thomson Reuters Westlaw product or the LexisNexis product. when people talked about going with a sole provider or going single source, it was really a matter of choosing one or the other. And I think what interested me when I, and what prompted me to write that post, was a recent survey that came out of the AmLaw 100 and 200 firms, and some comments that were around that, around purchasing and negotiating legal research, where the idea was that the sole provider doesn't really exist anymore as a choice, because you actually have not only the duopoly, the two main contenders, but you have a whole lot of other contenders that have emerged into the market in recent years. And so I think that is interesting, because from my perspective in a courthouse library, and sort of looking at the broader perspective of the legal profession, many of whom aren't in the AmLaw 100 and 200 law firms, particularly up here in Canada, I'm not sure that the choices really have changed beyond either Thomson Reuters, Westlaw, or LexisNexis, or perhaps nothing, or perhaps free.
Right.
So if sole provider means either or Thomson Reuters, Westlaw, or Relics, Lexis, is that the choice only at law libraries with less money allocated to licenses? So perhaps the courthouse libraries?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things. And as I find with a lot of my blogging, it's more posing questions than having any answers. What I think we're missing really is any really good data that tells us if there's a preference. If we tend to know if law firms, in particular the big law firms who get surveyed in these sorts of things, and sometimes other areas of law libraries, we tend to know that they're buying both of those products perhaps, or maybe they're buying one of those products plus, you know, an additional subscription from somewhere else. But we don't necessarily know which one, you know, how many have gone one way or the other. And we definitely don't know the rationales behind the decision making. And for example, in the courthouse libraries, where we might be limited to dollars, we may opt into a single source license because as a consortia, it makes more sense for us to go with one or the other based on the dollars. And the content isn't as much of an issue as the money is. And so the decision factors in the different types or the different contexts of law libraries can have, I think, a huge impact on what that is, and whether we're even able to consider something beyond an either or sole provider focus.
Yeah, I know that there's some barriers when it comes to selecting legal information providers. When I was at the Oklahoma Supreme Court, we had some limitations as well. In fact, that's where David and I actually first met, was when I was at OSCN. But I know that, you know, there can be limits based on state contracts, or I'm not sure how it is in Canada, if it's provincial government that sets up the limitations. And not only that, but some of these decisions that I've seen made in the past are by officials or senior management, which live outside the law library and sometimes even outside the legal department. What other factors come into play when it comes to selecting a provider? And are vendors allowing us to still order those a la carte so that we can get the best resources based on our unique needs?
I think it would depend on how you define that a la carte. And I think one of the really interesting things to me as I looked at those, the comments and looked at the post that was on your blog about sole providers is whether the question has been answered either that sole provider now includes a wider array of choices. And so are we saying that there are now law firms or other entities that are choosing, say, Bloomberg BNA as their sole provider, or have they chosen a commercial version of Fastcase as their sole provider? So I think that that's really interesting, because if they are, that's sort of one direction. And the other direction, I think, is the more traditional one, where we are essentially committing to one of the two longstanding commercial providers, Westlaw or Lexis. And then we are doing this a la carte. We're saying, you know, we're going to buy a little bit of Wolters Kluwer, or in Canada, we might buy a little bit of Irwin Law, and we're piecing it together. We're not necessarily piecing together the smallest pieces we want, you know, just the content we want. Mm-hmm. We're piecing together as much as the publishers will provide us.
And I know that there's been some information in the news about some publishers not allowing a la carte options if you don't have their primary. Well, I'll move away from that. That's a whole nother podcast on that one.
I mean, I thought that part of your article was quite interesting, because there are these different options out there, but you know, you were suggesting that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't even know about these or don't have an effective way to compare them. You know, just kind of going with the old standards because that's what they know, and there's a preference. How much of an impact does sort of lack of knowledge or that preference for certain vendors or titles play into what libraries or what law firms or attorneys are choosing?
It's a great question. And I think, again, it really highlights the lack of data that we have when we talk about decision-making in law libraries and who's making the decision and why. And again, if you think about the law firm, and generally I tend to think of the legal profession as 50% solos, 30% mid-size, which would be anywhere from 2 to 15 lawyers. And then you have sort of the bigger mid-size and the largest firms at the top. And so the choices that will happen across that spectrum are very, very different from solo to the biggest law firms. And then once you step away from the law firm perspective, you've got a whole lot of other things that are going on there. And I think what we may see, and I guess throwing back to Greg's comment about how it's a whole different other podcast, it may be that publishers make choices that sort of try to pan us into one choice or another. But I think that that also creates an environment where we can step away and say, you know what, we just need good enough. And so if you're going to make us choose this or that, then we're just going to go with that. And we're not going to expand into an a la carte mode. And we will just go towards either making a choice for a single source for our information if we can, or in the case of many lawyers, it looks like, I shouldn't say many, a substantial number of lawyers, they're saying, we're not going to buy anything and we're just going to make do with what we can find in other ways.
Yeah. I remember in the, and I'm throwing air quotes up here, good old days, you know, you didn't have to have a long-term subscription to a product in order to use it. You could literally use it a la carte and mm-hmm. pay by credit card. And of course, that went away in the mid-2000s decade. And now you're right. There seems to be painting you not just into a corner and making you decide, okay, if you're going to go sole provider and it's not us, then you can't use us at all. And so it's interesting. And I also wanted to comment that I think, and I'm going to throw this as a challenge out to ALM for their surveys. If you're saying we're not getting enough data on this, ALM provides a law library survey every year. And I think this would be something that they are positioned very well in order to get us that data. So ALM. Yeah. Take that on.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that data, you know, about sole providers. And David talked about some of the surveys on licensing for AmLaw, for the AmLaw 100 and 200, for mid-size, maybe small mid-size and mid-size, you know, in-house and other type of libraries. And what do those surveys tell us? Do they actually tell us anything since we're all kind of having this discussion? You know, how about other parts of the market? Solo firms, what are they doing? I'm asking like 10,000 questions all at once. Government agencies and courts, you know, academics,
et cetera.
And there are pieces out there that I think answer those questions. And I don't mean to point a finger at ALM necessarily, although they do have access to the
you
large
didn't.
Law firms.
I did.
Now, Greg did it for you.
But even, you know, even a survey from AALL or CALL is going to reach its membership, but that membership isn't necessarily the same as the market. And so I went back and I looked at a 2015 American Bar Association Legal Tech Survey report, and they actually have looked at online legal research trends for quite a while, and they don't tend to product choose. But they had one question, which was, do you conduct legal research using fee-based online resources? And the no's were pretty consistent, where you had 38% of solos saying no, but you also had 21% of lawyers and 500 plus firms saying no as well. So it's really interesting that the opt-out may be, if you're the solo, you're the decision maker and you're opting out, or probably as high as firms with 30 to 40 lawyers who may not have a librarian making those decisions for them. But you also have people opting out because from a business perspective, legal research really isn't part of what they're doing. Again, we don't know that that's actually the reason they're not using fee-based resources, but I think it's a complicated world, and it's made more complicated because we really don't know. We've got the publishers blocking our ability to share information through confidentiality clauses. And then we've got that lack of data that really digs into, you know, if I'm looking from my perspective as a courthouse librarian or a government librarian or a membership library, however you want to characterize the great library, do I have data that actually helps me to make my decision that's different from how your two law firms would be making decisions?
Yeah, like when I saw that in the article, I mean, I kind of went nuts because, you know, as a librarian, we're all very concerned about using some of the free resources and making sure that people understand what you get and what you don't get with some of the free resources. And I think you touched on this just now, that is it sort of the bundling and the licensing restrictions that are causing a problem? You know, what is the reason that people are doing this? Or, you know, or are they getting what they want? You know, are they getting enough?
I would tend to think that they're getting enough. And I think that has been a tension within the law library support of legal professionals for many, many years, maybe forever, but certainly for the last couple of decades, which is that we are trying to provide the best information we can and the broadest collection of content that we can that is authenticated and all that good stuff. And at the on the other side, we're seeing lawyers who may not have very good research skills, who see a plateau at some point that may be on a different level and lower than the legal research expectations that the librarians bring to that picture. And I think if you move down to that sort of what I've always called a good enough plateau, you know, the how much research do I need to do that's good enough to get me through this legal action or handle this client's matter or whatever, that good enough situation may actually say, I can get by in America with my Fast Case Bar Association affinity program, or in Canada with the $35 I pay for the Canadian Legal Information Institute, essentially, you know, quasi-free products, free-to-me products. And so that may be the thing, which is that, you know, we spend a lot of time focusing on something that many lawyers in the profession aren't actually going to care about.
What about like malpractice arguments or some of the guidelines that we're seeing about lawyers having to, you know, understand technology, not only just how to use technology, but sort of understanding the appropriate sources that are out there? How does that play into the discussion?
I think it plays into accountability, and I'm going to tread very carefully here because although I work at the Great Library, I'm not the Great Librarian, and we are the lawyer regulator for Ontario, so we regulate 60,000 lawyers and paralegals. So sometimes when I talk about stuff, people say, oh, well, the Law Society said, and it's like David Whelan said. But
opinions are your own, yes.
That's right. Okay. I think the challenge is that even if you have the rules that state those things, unless there are visible consequences for a failure to follow them, you're not really making an impact. So I think the technology comment to Model Rule 1.1 was interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that gets impacted, but we won't really know until we see ethical decisions, ethical opinions, or actual discipline cases that follow up on that. And I think that's what we've been missing on the legal research side, which is that although people may not be doing great legal research, and they may even be doing wrong legal research. I had a board chair that I worked with, and she ended up using one product, went into court, and the case had been overruled, but her product hadn't updated her to let her know that the case had been overruled literally within the last couple of days before her hearing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is that disciplinable malpractice or conduct, or is that just too bad for you? You had the wrong product, that sort of thing. So unless there are actual discipline decisions that relate to legal research use or legal research choice, I think it's very hard to see anything that would move lawyers to move away from a good enough approach.
I wanted to back up because you said something that I found very interesting. There's someone with the title of Great Librarian?
That was my position up until about 20, 25 years ago. The Great Library was run by the Great Librarian.
Well, there you go.
Oh, that's so awesome.
I'm changing my title tomorrow. well, David, let's get to the meat of this. Your article was entitled The No Legal Research Provider Landscape. So what about the lawyers who appear to have opted out of any fee-based provider, what you call the no provider landscape? What are the options for the lawyers who just say no to Westlaw or Lexis?
I think there are lots of really good options for them. And that, I think, poses a challenge both for law librarians who are trying to deliver legal research services to lawyers, as well as to the legal publishers who have to now really decide, you know, how do we deal with that? In the 2015 ABA survey, it's a quarter of the lawyers. It was 40% of the lawyers in the Ontario survey that we had from 2016. So it's a sizable number of people who are opting out. And I think it depends a little bit on where you are. In America, everybody, I think all 50 states have a bar association that has an affinity program with either Casemaker or Fastcase. So all of those lawyers essentially have free membership access to a substantial body of legal information. In Canada, we have CanLee. In England and Australia, you have, or the UK and Australia, you have other legal information institutes that support that free access. So I think you actually have if you're looking at case laws or primary law as the fundamental need, most lawyers will have free access to something that is decent. It's not editorialized, it's not enhanced, but it's also questionable whether those things are actually meaningful anymore.
Yeah, well, since you mentioned CanLee and some of the other legal information institutes, I did want to put a quick note in that Tom Bruce from Cornell has retired, and he has been running the Legal Information Institute for, 28 years, something like that? So good job, Tom, and hope you enjoy your retirement.
Yeah, Tom's legacy, I think, is incredibly large, particularly outside of the United States. And that may not be visible to everybody because we do have legal information institutes that are tied very closely to the government and have, in a sense, become the government publisher for a lot of the primary law.
So where do you see this conversation going over the next decade? Will there be more options out there for the legal profession? You know, do you see a gulf between those who have lots of money to spend versus those who can't afford to have duplicated resources or simply desire a no provider collection?
I think what we may see is that the legal publishers who have been using the print subscriptions to buoy their business, their electronic business, and their non-legal research publishing business are going to find it harder and harder to justify licenses to any but the biggest law firms, probably the biggest law firms in the US, but even in the UK and in Canada and Australia. Because I think that the reality is that you can do a lot of your research without having to use one of those quote unquote comprehensive services. You can either do an a la carte piecing together of pieces, you can use one of these emerging providers, or you can really put a lot of reliance on, say, a free reliance on Canley in Canada, for example, but then I enhance it with an a la carte secondary license to cover that part of the collection. So where before we would be looking at commercial providers for both the primary and the secondary, I think now we are going to see in the next couple of years, next 10 years for sure, the ability to go primary on for free and secondary for a more competitive price.
I love the fact that we were almost to the end of this interview before the word books even came up. Hey, David, thanks for joining us. We've been talking with David Whelan, the Director of Legal Information and the Great Library, and the former Great Librarian, apparently, of the Law Society of Ontario in Toronto. Thanks again, David, for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Marlene.
So, Greg, David gave us so much to think about in that segment. One of the things that really got me was how information gatekeepers might actually be biased in terms of choice of resources. We may put too much emphasis on authors or publishers or platforms based on preference or popularity or even the old ways of doing research that we've been taught. So that's really something to think about. Mm-hmm. You know, when I do think about it, I know certainly I've experienced this from the patron side, you know, opinions that one source or platform is better than another. And, you know, oftentimes this is because they use one and one is a favorite, but they don't use another. Now, Susan Nevlo-Mart started on a road to demystify the differences between the research platforms. And I think we need to continue on this path and expand it to better inform customers, not only about the differences between the platforms, but about what platforms that they actually need.
Yeah, there's actually, you know, quite a negative connotation on the phrase gatekeeper. And so, you know, I'm a little concerned on that. And I think David was pretty good at talking about his good enough with lawyers on using resources. Yep. And I know that law librarians tend to want things to be not good enough. They want it to be great. And
well, not only law librarians, but I think practitioners as well.
Yeah.
That's always been the standard, was, you know, kind of the gold standard in terms of access to resources. And now we're, you know, kind of being forced to look at things a different way.
Yeah. And one of the things I think I've run into my entire law library career is that, and I've said it before on the show, is that we usually don't lack for resources, but what we lack is having people understand which resource to use at the right time.
Yeah, which to use when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, you know, it goes back to this. The purse strings tend to be in the law library, and there's a great responsibility. I feel like I'm Spider-Man now.
I was going to say, it's like Spider-Man came into my mind.
I'm going to be Uncle Ben for a second, you know. And so with the responsibility of managing that budget, we really need to make sure that the resources we have are top notch. You know, get the best bang for the buck.
And, you know, I really think, you know, the one takeaway, if you don't take away anything else, is kind of, you know, keep an open mind. You know, what David is saying, it's like, look, there are options out there. And no, we definitely do not have enough information to make choices all the time, but we do have some. It's really just about keeping an open mind about the different resources that are out there and how they can work together to have an effective platform for the practices that you have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hey, and one quick side note is I do want to wish David and his family a safe and speedy return of David's brother.
Exactly.
Yes. Who's been held in Russia since, I believe, since December. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thoughts are with you guys.
Yeah. Remember to subscribe to The Geek and Review on your favorite podcast platform. You can contact us on Twitter at GayBauerM or at Glambert with your comments or suggestions, or call us on the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270 and leave us some ideas for topics. And hey, Greg,
yeah,
we really need an invite to Yale to check out the best pizza. Let's work on that.
I will warn Teresa that New Jerseyans aren't as easy to impress as New York.
I got to taste it.
And of course, thanks to Jerry David DeSica for his awesome music that you hear on the podcast.
Thank you, Jerry.
All right. I'll talk to you later, Marlene.
Bye-bye.